Well, yippee-ki-yay, it's another episode of I've Been Dice, the podcast about war games and board games. I'm your host, Tom Grant, and in this episode, our panel discusses 2013 in review. It's not a best of or in the normal sense of the term where we rank things in an arbitrary scale of 1 to 10 about games that we liked or hated or whatever, but we do talk about our best gaming experiences, games that delighted us, disappointed us, so that's coming up soon. And afterwards, something came up with the upfront Kickstarter project that got me going about Kickstarter, so I have a brief audio essay about Kickstarter and the good and the bad that it's done for the board game hobby. But first, let's get to the gratuitous 2013 in review section, which is already in progress. So here we are with our gratuitous best of 2013 and worst of 2013 show. This is Tom. We also have here, I am not a Cylon Kevin.
Incorrect.
I've been lucky enough to play multiple games of It Never Snows, Jason.
Yes, multiple incomplete games, yes.
Okay. And I can do math, TJ.
Hi.
4 out of 3 times.
4 out of 3 times,
exactly.
Okay. So, our topics are going to be the best and worst. We kind of play fast and loose here. We're not going to have a definite number that we have to have, like 10, you know, of the best or anything like that. We're just throwing out what we feel is most noteworthy in each of these categories. And we're going to start with best gaming experience of 2013. So I've got a list, but one of you guys jump in first.
Well, I'll jump in first. I actually have a list also. So, because I kept track on my iPad this year and on BoardGameGeek, I actually know when I played things. And also, okay. I can kind of see when I look at by date, I get kind of a picture of what the night was. So my first one I'm going to share is June 5th.
Okay.
And on that night, we played a bunch of short games. We played King of Tokyo, of course, but it was also the first time I played Spikerstad,
yep.
Which was okay. Diamant, which was really great. Coup, it was the first time we played Coup. That was really great. And actually, strangely, it was the first time I ever played Liar's Dice, and that was awesome. Mm-hmm. So it was a blast that night.
Yeah. I'm actually incredibly happy to hear you say that, because I've been reluctant to bring over a lot of these sort of shorter, arguably pure Euros or whatever, thinking that they wouldn't go over so well, because you've sort of had a history of bleeping things on your old podcast.
Right. Well, okay. I've got to admit that as we go through this list, I am going to be, one of my goals for 2014 is going to have to be getting back my war game cred, because I have so many Euros all over this thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. What about you, TJ? Anything?
You know, it'd been great if you'd given us the topics beforehand. Oh, wait.
I did. Oh, no.
No, you have a list. You go.
Okay, so I'll say my list includes, first of all, Andy and Abyss. The games we played with that I really enjoyed. I thought that, we haven't played more than once A Distant Plane or Cuba Libre, so I have no opinion strongly about those yet. But we played Andy and Abyss enough where I felt solid in saying, boy, that was an enjoyable gaming experience. I know you disagree, Kevin, but...
Well, see, some of the same games that are on your best and worst list are on my best and worst list.
Yes. So we agree on that. Had a blast with Battlestar Galactica with you guys. That was a ton of fun. Angola, I think, was a real discovery. So this list is very much the opposite of yours, Jason, in that they're very long. And they're all obviously war games except for Battlestar Galactica. And then an odd one. So something that's on my best and worst list is Online Eclipse.
Oh, okay. So yeah, we were going to come to that.
Yeah,
sure.
So the night that we played and we were all online at the same time was a lot of fun. The rest of it was dreadful because it was so slow and there were so many things not helpful in playing it. Like,
sure.
You couldn't see what the other players did in their turns before you.
Well, then this is part of the worst iOS adaptation or online adaptation of a board game, is that it was not well done. And the fact that you couldn't see what just happened unless, I don't know, maybe there was some logs
brutal.
You could go through or something. I don't know. But it looked pretty, but it was kind of broken. We were just early adopters. I mean, we got it when it first came out. We tried to play it. We were foolish.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that you could infer from looking at the board certain things that happened, but just please, just a list of events, anything.
Yeah.
But
in the end, even if it was a perfect adaptation, they did the perfect job, I'm not sure that's a good asynchronous game. In fact, it may be a pretty bad asynchronous game to play.
Yeah. But anyway, that's what I had on my best gaming experience list.
Okay.
Well, I will say probably it's hard not to say Gathering of Friends that I go to in April. It's
Hell Well, la-di-da. Yeah.
No.
Envy.
I mean,
Envy emoticon. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't have my list of what I played there.
Well,
it's
I was
just a lot
with
of
the elite. I had a fabulous time. Fabulous.
I mean, really, but what it is I have a lot of old friends I go see, people that I've known for like 20 years. And so, to be honest, there's a lot of going out for breakfast, going out for dinner, hanging out and talking, and playing with each other and the games that have just come out or some old standards. Like, there's a particular game called DTM. Actually, Tom Stewart has a copy. It's this kind of real-time racing game where you roll three dice and you have 20 seconds to make your move, and we always end this one Saturday night playing this big, you know, 8-player game of this, and it's just a ton of fun.
Yeah.
The whole event. But the other thing is, weirdly enough, may actually be, and maybe this is a different category of biggest surprise, is I can't stop thinking about A Distant Plane. I really thought I was going to dislike it, and I didn't even know exactly what we were doing, but I really loved the fact that Jason and I were, you know, coalition and the Afghan government, and that we had shared objective. We were really tied at the hip and doing completely different things, and we were walking around like spasmodic drunks, and maybe when you played the game really well, you'd only walk around like drunks, but...
Right.
It was very interesting.
Drunks without epilepsy.
Right.
So I have a couple others. If I could share those.
Please.
Pseudocon Saturday, which is
more
elite than
Gathering
of Friends.
Absolutely.
And it's only a few people.
Gathering of Friends of Children.
Yeah.
All right. Pseudocon Saturday, played Middle Earth Quest, played 4-player Mage Knight. And it was my first play of Escape from the Temple, which is probably a game that is best played the first time you play it. Because you know, you're not used to playing this kind of dice, this crazy dice thing, and listening, trying to figure out what exactly the different sounds are. And it was a lot of fun. And then also, I would also say August 1st, which was at WBC, which I'm going to call Win in Rome Day, which was the day we played Republic of Rome and discovered Command & Conquer's Epic Ancients, which was awesome. That was
will have to say that was the biggest eye-opener, because I was actually kind of lukewarm, pretty much lukewarm on Command & Conquer's Ancients, but the Epic version of it with 4 people per side,
it was really hard
to compare with anything else. And it was played like 5 or 6 times over the course of 2 days.
Yeah.
And it was the same scenario over and over and over again.
It was
that much fun.
Yeah, it's almost like a different game.
It's a different game, and it's a 10 times better game.
Yeah. And then the last thing on my list would be playing the Standard Combat Series games with my son Owen. You know, we played Africa and It Never Snows, and that was awesome too.
Okay.
That's what I got.
Anything from you, Kevin?
Well, I would say a lot of the open gaming that we did at WBC, I was going to say Command & Conquer's Ancients Epic, that was fun. Battlestar Galactica, just because it's Battlestar Galactica. And then Dune. And, you know, it's always fun to play Dune, but also on top of that, to teach some people Dune that hadn't played before and then have them say, oh, this was a lot of fun, you know, that was rewarding.
Yeah.
Went the full distance. That was the first time I'd ever played Dune where it went the full distance. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, worst gaming experience. Who's ready to pounce on that one?
So what are the 3 coin games I've played?
Okay, so for the listeners, what is it you dislike about the coin games?
At my level of play, it feels like... whatever I take just gets taken back, and I can't think of options to do anything that would result in anything different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you know, ironically, the first time I played Twilight Struggle, I felt like that about it. I placed three influence, you placed three influence. I coup it, you coup it back.
Right.
Okay, now I love the game because I learned more about what your different options actually are.
Mm-hmm. That is a very open-minded statement. okay. Who else? Worst gaming experience.
This would also be in the summer. We had too many people here. I think we had seven. I think you were here for that.
Yeah.
It was too many. I mean, the only thing we could do was we could play Seven Wonders, and then somebody left, and then we played City of Horror. And then, you know, it was just awkward and uncomfortable, and it was, like I said, too many people. If we had seven or eight people show up this summer, I'm either going to split the two groups, or I'm pulling out Tomb of Horrors and giving preset characters, and we'll just kill people as much as we can. So that's pretty much it. But that would be it for me. I had a good year. That was still not a horrible experience, but I had a good year. So
you're gonna hate this, and I haven't given this a lot of thought.
It's all right.
But we recently played. This was at Micro Pseudocon. We played Sword of Rome, 5 players, 4.5 players.
Okay.
And
on
it's
my list.
Sort of validated.
See, it's on my list of worst too.
Okay. It validated my fears about the game. And I don't want to go into too much other than to say that I think that the way the combat system works could be revamped. There's too much chance that your entire position explodes and shatters into a million pieces and it's too hard to recover, that there's too much reward for simply scooping up the weak's position and pushing them into a hopeless, crippled position. And as the Germanic, the Gauls, I think that one of their good options is to get into some weird parasitic relationship with the Etruscans, where the Etruscans just allow them to pillage, and maybe even allow them to take their one city so that they can loot it, and then team up against the Romans with them. But it would be presumably an ahistorical parasitic relationship.
I don't think it's necessarily wrong. I mean, I don't want to speak to the Etruscans and the Gauls, but the idea that there would be these successive invasions and then you'd basically let them rampage a little bit and buy them off to go home was not an unheard of thing in the ancient world.
And part of my reason for saying this is how much I love Hannibal Rome versus Carthage. Mm. Even though I've only played it maybe 8 or 9 times in my life, it's such a fantastic 2-player experience. And Sword of Rome is a very, very similar game system. It's a pretty direct port in some ways, except the combat system. Mm. And it's turned into a multiplayer game, 4-player or even a 5-player game version of it. And it isn't a 20th of Hannibal in terms of game experience.
I agree with that.
Well, I don't know. That's the way I feel. Maybe it's a 10th. But okay. I'm very disappointed in it, and I'm probably going to give up on it. Anyway, that's my
okay, so I put it on my list of worst gaming experiences, but for different reasons.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I felt bad that it sucked everybody who was playing into something that lasted hours and hours and hours when probably, from Micro Pseudocon, you guys wanted to play something else. And so I felt pretty bad about that. But secondly, it surprised me because when we've played it before, we being my old gaming group back in California, we could play it in an evening, a weeknight. You know, it was not a game that went that long.
It is incredible. That is incredible to think of. I mean, really is.
But it's like Dune, actually, in the sense that a game of Dune could go 90 minutes if Harkonnen's taken on turn 3 or 4 or something, or it can go 7 hours if it's a 15-turn slog, maybe only 6. But I mean, it can be 3 or 4-fold time difference. I think.
Well, tournament rules these days is 10 turns, not 15.
Okay, but sure, if you play by the book, I mean, it can go at least six hours if it goes a full game,
mm-hmm.
or it can be really short if Harkonnens win their initial, stab at winning on turn 3 or 4.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing was, I think the game was not putting its best foot forward for a couple of reasons. I think the inexperience of the Carthaginian player kind of threw things out of whack a bit. you know, the Carthaginians were not as much of a threat as they usually are in that game. Secondly, I was playing to prove a point.
Right.
The Etruscan Samnites. You know, that UTJ had said, oh, these guys are dopes. They, you know, they're not going to ever be a threat. You know, and, you know, I played my first few turns just to be as nasty as I possibly could at them, just to say, okay, they are a force to be reckoned with if, you know, you play them right. And then it totally collapsed because I was over-aggressive. And I think that messed up the game a bit. But anyway, that was one of my worst.
And one odd thing that happened in that game was when there was inexperience on the Carthaginian player is you threatened him. You said, if you do this, I will rip, I think you said, I will tear your kingdom to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he was calling your bluff.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he was not.
What
ended up happening was you tore his kingdom to pieces, and then he was, and it was a process of tearing his kingdom to pieces. You did the first couple steps, and he still thought you were bluffing. And by the time he realized that what you were wielding, it was over. And he spent the rest of the game trying to recover.
Yeah. For those listening, it was the rebellion part, you know, that the Carthaginians, someone else can use the NPC player card, the, you know, the non-player kingdoms to then, you know, basically screw up the Carthaginians because they're rebellions at home and they have to run back and go fix things.
Yeah, and it absolutely crushed him.
The other kind of similarly overlong game that I found annoying, and this again is kind of weird that it's a game I really like, was that session of Mage Knight we played with the expansion.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Oh my god, that was so long. And it, I felt like there was no warning in the expansion to say, this may go a very long time compared to your previous experiences running Mage Knight.
Boy, I should have put both those on my list.
Yeah.
So this reminded me of something. When was our Descent experience?
Well, that was next on my list.
Okay, it was this year. Huzzah! Yes. We have solved our problems. So, that was the top of my list.
So, which I now call the constipation game because the game is all about blockage. That was just, you know, because we tried to really see if that game could work. You know, we did not kind of go into it. I mean, we had some skepticism, I would say, but we didn't try to, you know, piss all over it from the very beginning.
No, and to set this up, we had played this, maybe it wasn't the first thing we did, but we played the intro scenario, which is very tiny, and then we played the first half of one of the quests, and it was all good. It was looking very, very, it was entertaining.
It was looking promising.
It was looking very, it looked so promising. During the next couple
and
weeks,
then some jerk figured
blocking. No. What happened was I actually painted two of the figures, my character and one other character, and I had not painted a miniature in 25 years or role playing figure, and I was so excited I did that. And we came back the next session, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have on my list the night we decided that Descent wasn't working. Also, that was a rough night. It was just a night where everybody was uncomfortable.
Because we played, you know, one scenario after another. It was multiple scenarios in one night. And it was the same problem over and over again. It wasn't just like there was one scenario that was kind of hinky. It was,
well, and we
this
even,
game is messed up.
We even went so far as to start new characters.
Yeah.
And start it all over again. We didn't get very far. We played a scenario we'd never played, a quest we never played. And it was the circular Keystone Cops ridiculous thing because you had, you know, flesh molders that could heal your main guy that if he died you lost, and you had some awesome blocking dude that could move through things, and it was just
okay.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. So my comment to,
it's only a good game if the Overlord is terrible.
Yeah.
And Kevin is not terrible. Well, terrible in one sense.
So I would say to people who do like it, including the people who do Shut Up and Sit Down, the podcast.
No. They liked it when they first played it. They basically did the same thing. They played, like, the intro quest, half of one scenario.
I just listened to the latest podcast, and they said that they were going to, you know, go out and buy a bunch of expansions and...
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I thought I heard later where
so
they
I
were knocking
say,
on it.
So I would ask people who like it, are you playing the Overlord competitively?
It's sort of like Mansions of Madness, which I've never played but heard from multiple sources, including the guys that Shut Up and Sit Down, that if the DM, the Overlord character, runs it as a DM, an experience, is rather than a competitive thing. It can be a lot of fun. It's thematic, and there's other issues in terms of price and replayability. But if you play it competitively as the bad guy, he has way too much information, and he can just screw you over, and it's not interesting.
Well, but might not they reply, are you sure you're playing the adventurers competitively?
Yeah, but, you know, we've heard stories about, you know, from other sources about the game getting, you know, kind of snowballing too much in the favor of the players, or too much in favor of the Overlord. I don't know. It's a game that I don't want to ever play again. And I already mentioned Online Eclipse and that, how disappointing that was. So any other worst gaming experiences? Are we feeling purged?
Yeah.
Okay. Biggest pleasant surprise. I can jump off with that one.
Sure.
Vietnam Solitaire. I'm going to write a review of this soon. I really was struck by, not that the fact that it was a perfect game, that I think there has some significant flaws, but I can kind of be forgiving, given the subject matter is so complex, that an effort to do a simple solitaire game is going to not do a lot of things justice. But I thought it did a few things really well that kind of surprised me. So that was one. City of Horror was another one. A game I enjoyed, despite the fact that I am oh so tired of zombies. Mm-hmm. That I thought that game was a ton of fun. Maneuver, the couple of times that you and I played it, Kevin, I was kind of rediscovered that game and really enjoyed it. And then last of all on my list, the fact that the high-flying dice catalog exists, that there are all these interesting little games that Paul Warbaugh has designed, and they're available at a relatively cheap price, and I think that's just terrific. And you know, I hadn't even known about them before 2013, and I think that there's a lot of good that company is doing in kind of bringing games to market on subjects that might otherwise get covered, or make it easy for people to jump into the wargaming hobby because it's so cheap. So anyway, that was my other pleasant surprise. All right, what do you guys think? Any pleasant surprises?
Kevin, why don't you jump in?
Go ahead. I think earlier we were saying we were pleasantly surprised at Epic Command and Colors.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, that's why I wanted you to say it first.
I think it'd be an interesting discussion to say, so what's the discrepancy between what the expectation was and what the reality was? I mean, what was it about the game that made it a surprise? What assumptions did we have going in thinking, it's going to be okay, compared to what it was?
Well, I like Command & Colors Ancients in general. And I played a lot of it, and really I thought what was going to happen was my experience, I thought it was going to be my experience with Command & Colors Ancients minus. I thought it was going to be minus some cards, minus some ability to do things, minus the ability to command my own troops. And really what it turned out to be was out to be plus. I mean, it was really fun to sit right across from you, yet know that I was on a team of players.
Right.
When something went, there was, it was also one of those weird atmosphere things where there was cheering and there was kind of some kibitzing, although I know we kind of stopped doing that after a while, but and I think all of that really contributed to it. You know, there really is something about playing a game loudly is fun.
I think part of it for me, and it sounded like maybe you're saying the same thing, is I wouldn't have realized it at the time, but in hindsight, I think I worried, you know, if I'm one of the lieutenants and if I don't agree with how my commander is giving orders, then it can't be fun for me to execute. But it was, because I don't know if it's because I still have enough leeway what to do with what he ordered, or, you know, even if it's a dumb thing to do, it's still a fun game, you know, mm-hmm. go do it, see mm-hmm. what happens. Mm-hmm. So that fear was a false fear. Yeah. And then I think probably the fear that any war game with 8 players, it's just not going to be fun,
right.
It's going to be slow. But it was fun, and it wasn't slow.
Right. So there would be another thing I could play if we have 8 players over the summer.
Absolutely,
I would definitely do that again.
Yeah.
So I sort of hear what you're saying about you thought it was going to be CNC Ancients minus in terms of, like, it's a fixed fun game. There's this much fun, and rather than you getting all of it playing on this side, you're dividing it by 3 or 4 slices.
Right.
But it's not. It's actually
right.
more than
I think the counter example would be Napoleonic Wars. I know a lot of people like it 5-player. I like it 3-player. Adding the 4th and 5th just means I get less play time.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
Yes. Makes sense. And when I was I was worried that being the commander, like when we played it 4-on-4, so if 3 players on a side get center, left, and right of this really wide board, and then the 4th person gets this, you know, draws from a special deck a big fistful of cards and then doles out a card or not to his 3 respective things. And I thought, how interesting can that be? But oh my God, you're pacing back and forth behind your people trying to assess the entire board and like who's going to get what. It's really fun.
It was a lot of fun. And I mean, I think that when I thought about, everybody praised Epic Ancients, I thought they were saying, you know, having the huge battlefield and being a solo commander gave you so many more options, it was more fun. But, you know, playing the team I'm not sure I would like that as much as I like playing the team. It was a lot of fun.
And I think that's how Richard tends to play it with his group in Orlando.
I'm not surprised.
And so that may be really experience that he was aiming for.
Are there any plans you're aware of for Epic Napoleonics CNC?
I have not heard.
I can't imagine there are not, because, I mean, they did the Overlord for Memoir 44. I can't imagine. I mean, I think that they always had that eye, but I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, and I think actually, I don't know how many people really play, you know, CNC Napoleonics, but, you know, there are games that kind of set the hobby, you know, kind of more in a direction of a particular subject, the way that Paths of Glory did with World War One. I would bet a really good team Napoleonics game would have that effect on Napoleonics.
Sure, right.
Oh, yeah. It might be just so much better that way.
I would also say another pleasant surprise for me is that you like City of Horror. We're going to be able to play it again. Because I like it too.
I was actually shocked.
When we had played it, like that, you know, I put it on one of my worst gaming experiences because that night when we played it, I felt like everybody left the table and I was like, oh my God, this is kind of like the zombie apocalypse. You know, the zombies were everywhere and everybody just got kind of sick of them. You know, it was kind of like, the next season of Walking Dead potential video.
Well, now that a certain annoying character is dead, it can only be that.
So I actually have a couple more, just more briefly. One of them is actually Academy Games 1775. Is that who makes that?
Uh-huh, that's a good game.
It is shockingly good for what it is, with just colored cubes. It's 4 players, small deck of cards, and it's I played 1812. And I bought it, but I hadn't played it. Played it at WBC and thought, wow, this is really fun. 5 players, really fun. And then you guys bought 1775 and said it was better. And then
I still think it's better.
And it is. And I played 1775 Pseudocon, I think. Mm-hmm. And I agree, it's better. It's so much fun.
Yeah,
really way better than you would expect it to be. Another, did we first play Blood Bowl Team Manager calendar year?
Yeah,
and again, that is way better than it has any right to be.
Right.
It's very clever and a lot of fun. And of course, I said something about a distant plane I was queasy about playing that because I feel like playing a game it's not over. It'd be like 1943 and we're playing World War II ETO game. And it's like,
why is that a problem?
I don't feel comfortable doing that. I feel a little uncomfortable doing it. Like, it's like history. Like, there's journalism and there's history, and in order to evaluate things, you need maybe a little distance, you need a little closure, a little, like, poking under crevices of things that you didn't maybe know at the time to evaluate it, and when something is still going on and all the stuff that is wrapped up in this whole thing politically, I thought this is not going to be good. But I was really, really surprised.
One thing I would say about that is that I think that was the Vietnam problem. You know, I can remember being young and Vietnam games coming out, and I think that they struggled for that very reason.
But what if you were playing a Vietnam game in 1969
or 70? That's what I'm saying. I think that those games struggled because they were too close and we didn't know all the historical stones had not been overturned. But what a distant plane does that I think makes it work is it paints in broad strokes. So it's not trying to overturn every stone. It's giving you a broad view of the conflict.
Yeah.
And I think maybe so it doesn't fall into the trap that you were concerned about as readily as some other games might have.
I think Vietnam's a little different. So for those listening who are younger than those seated here at the table, they don't have memories of this, but it was sometimes impossible to have a civil conversation about Vietnam.
Sure, right.
I mean, people were so divided about the war and what the real war was, and was there a winning strategy, and if so, why didn't we pursue it? I don't have the same problem you do about ongoing conflicts, because I look at a game the same way I look at a book or, you know, a foreign affairs article or something like that.
Right,
it's representing something,
right,
and
right.
You know, not in the same way as an article, but we can comfortably talk about ongoing conflicts.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the things I admired about listening to your show, is that you like those sorts of things. You like these Brian Train games and these, you know, low-intensity conflict games, which I sort of danced around, but
mm-hmm.
I never really played, and I was always a little uncomfortable with, and now I'm more comfortable with it, and I have more confidence in Volko, actually, as a designer,
yeah.
That, like, I'm looking forward to see what he does next.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be the Vietnam version of Coin that comes out.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Biggest unpleasant surprise. Game you thought you'd like more than you...
Well, I mean, I already said Descent.
Descent.
You know, I had such massively huge expectations, and it was even built up from our first session. And
you know, I haven't beaten up on this enough, but I felt like Descent the same way I did when I watched Prometheus. It's like, how much money did you spend on this to make a really inadequate product? You know, and, you know, Prometheus, I felt like this more so because as a big Alien fan from long ago, you know, it's like, really? Really?
Yeah, it was really hard to watch.
But, you know, it's just like, okay, this over massively overproduced game for what it was then, just anyway, I'm ranting.
I had Descent also. I said, I said that it was the dungeon plugging. It was dungeon plugging by Kevin in Descent, and then I followed it up by dungeon plugging in Mutant Citadels. Mutant Chronicles of the City.
Siege of the Citadel.
Siege of the Citadel.
Hey, we both did that.
And it is a, it, and you know, the so what bothered me about it, the unpleasant surprise, was that suddenly the dungeon crawl board game looks as unattainable as the 1 hour Civ game.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm very concerned about that.
Yeah.
So.
All right. I put on my list Exodus Proxima Centauri when we played that at WBC.
Oh yeah, if I had remembered that, that would be on the list.
Yeah.
I'm reconstructing the memories now.
Because again, it was the hype cycle, right? You know, so there was like this new game that came out and people were saying how great it was and so forth. And all somebody since finally cracked the code on the shorter version of Twilight Imperium, it was not significantly shorter. And I feeling like about the biggest space opera games, like, okay, either do something, bite the bullet and do something long like Twilight Imperium and throw in a whole bunch of stuff because you think that's what your player base really wants, or do something different. You know, do a Space Empires game that isn't following the same 4X formula of building up over time and battling over some objectives, and that's just kind of built in to be a long game.
My complaint would be slightly different. I don't necessarily want it to be completely rethought. I just want it to be done really competently.
Yeah.
And I felt like this was very far from that tree, which was frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because there should be, I mean, the bar right now should be at least competent,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps outstanding, and
yeah.
This was, I thought, really pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just saying the physical production, I didn't like the gameplay.
Yeah. Anything else from you guys? I got a couple more, but I want to give you a chance.
What was that Civ game that we played?
Clash of Cultures.
I think that fits multiple categories. It was disappointment. It was pleasant surprise. It was the game that got away.
Yeah.
And I think the reason it was so bittersweet was because
it sounds like a movie blurb.
Like a chick
you'll flick. Laugh. You'll cry.
You'll look for the sick bag.
And I think it's because it was so close.
Yeah.
Close. It had some really interesting mechanics. You know, the fact that you can't build cities larger than the number of cities you have.
Or the number of different buildings or whatever, yeah.
This kind of throttling mechanism where the bad events don't happen until you grow to a certain size, you know, almost like certain Star Trek episodes where,
mm-hmm.
you know, as soon as you achieve space flight, then the satellite zaps you, what have you. But in the end, it just, somehow the soup was missing.
Are you willing to try that again? You didn't play that, did you? Would you be willing to play that four player again? Try that again to see how it goes?
I would play it again. I wouldn't be too optimistic. I don't think it would be a painful experience, but I'm not too optimistic that we would come out of it saying, oh,
yeah, I would like to give it another go, especially since you haven't tried it. Especially since I bought it and I want it to be worthwhile.
Interesting tech tree. So, I mean, there's a lot of things going for it.
I would give it another go, but I'm not choosing it on my.
That's fine.
Because I am not hopeful, but
sometimes it turns around. Time, so you pick what you want.
I will play Descent. As a matter of fact, I am.
Yes. Let's not go there.
Turn off the recording.
Okay, that will be two players.
I might actually have. I don't know.
It is an abusive thing. Here's the problem with Descent. It's an abusive relationship because I am actually willing to almost say that I want to try it again.
I withdraw the comment because we talked about it on more than one blog.
I know.
Honey, I have changed.
That's right. It's like. Yeah.
Okay. I also put down Doctor Who, the card game. I love you, Martin.
Yeah.
You're such a good designer, but that was such a blah game.
Yeah. It did win the Gen Con Award. Or Origins Award. It won the Origins Award.
Of most name recognition?
Of best card game.
Oh.
Any others? I got one last one.
No.
Okay. So this is for you, TJ. The C4 Counter Cutter.
Yes.
So to give some backdrop to those listening. So TJ's been trying to convince me to clip my counters. I have not been a counter clipper. And he had brought out this industrial device that... he was using for this, and I thought, okay, I can be sold on the idea of counter clipping, but I don't necessarily need the corners to be totally rounded and nice and so forth.
Oh, yeah, so what Tom's talking about, and I can't remember the company, it's like some Oregon laminate technical industries. If you go to Board Game Geek and look for one of the longest threads ever, like
the perfect solution for counter clipping.
It's ridiculous, and it's this, they're made for laminated things, and... it actually creates incredibly wonderful corners, but you have to be a little careful.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So this could just be me.
I partially clipped Tom's copy of Angola, while we were playing.
Yeah,
and so it's only partially clipped.
Yeah, but it looked nice, and I said, okay, you know, I don't have a lot of time. I don't want to do it as slowly as you were doing it.
Well, because we were playing at the same time.
Right, so I got the C4 counter cutter, and I could have gotten a bad... copy of one, or I could be just a gorilla and I'm prone to breaking things, but I broke it. And I snapped off, I was holding it down, and I don't think I was applying too much pressure, and I was putting the X-Acto knife down, and it snapped. And I was like, okay, I can't really repair this, because I'd have to get the little thing glued in place and so forth. So, after years and years and years of not clipping counters...
That was terrible. So, what did you think of the counters you'd managed to clip before you broke
they
looked fine. It?
They looked, they didn't look as nicely rounded as yours.
No, because you can't. That's why it's a 200-page blog, because it makes these ridiculous. They look professional. They look like
But can I say something about that
Napoleonic 20 series where they have the nice counters with the rounded things and they punch out like butter? They look like that.
But that thread just seemed like. I don't know, like having Sunnis and Shiites arguing.
No. It's they're not really arguing. It's all trying to dial in exactly whether you need the 2mm or the 3mm.
Okay.
And in fact, due to that discussion, the guy actually who owns the company created a 2.5mm clipper.
Wow.
Sounds more like a scrapbooking site, but
yeah. Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, there is a bit of that. I mean, people
okay,
are talking.
But anyway.
It's kind of a scrapbooking corner of the hobby, actually.
Yes, I won't speak of your savagery.
It's like
Jason just rips them apart with giant hairy type shoe counters.
That's what I do.
I'll
tell you something else I do, and this is also something that caused some horror on another podcast, the ASL podcast, the Hat Squad one. I will sometimes throw away boxes.
Yeah, that did cause horror on that.
That's not right.
Yeah. I
haven't done that. I can't go that far.
Yeah, my ASL stuff, I put it all in the Plano. And of course, that's another whole discussion about Plano. But, and I chuck the boxes. And like, why am I going to keep the boxes around?
Anyway. Good point.
So that when you design a game, you'll have something to put it in.
Yeah, right. Okay, the game I wish I'd played in 2013. Anything that you were really keen on doing that you hadn't played?
Well, I wanted to play ASL.
You know what? That is a strong statement. I will make that happen for you. For me, it would be Mage Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Good choice. Yeah.
Interested in it. Seems like a great game for my son and I to play. Just never got into it. Sounds like it's got some interesting things where you're designing your own spell books, kind of putting your own deck together and then playing each other. Sounds like it might be Summoner Wars plus a little bit of extra stuff. And I wish I'd played it and I didn't get a chance to.
So I have Napoleonic Wars, which I've still not played.
Oh, okay. That's not on my list because we actually got a three-player game in, which was great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. If I'd known that, I would have chosen that for tonight.
Iron and Oak, the Civil War naval game that came out. I'm really keen on playing that. And then because I bought it, and I feel like I need to play it then to justify it, Where Eagles Dare, which I've heard good things about the system. It's going to be a project to get actually to play it, but it's something I really do want to try to play sometime. Mm-hmm. Any others on your lists?
I just had the one.
Okay. The game that got away. Anything that you wish you'd purchased or you wish you hadn't sold?
For me, and this is just goofiness, I would put that Firefly game that went up on Kickstarter and then went away.
You can buy that at Kazaa.
No, there are two Firefly games.
Yeah, there's a different one.
There's one that came out that was called like Out of the Black or something like that, or Into the Black. I don't know. That's a Neil Young song too.
Somewhere, I'm sorry. Somewhere in our listening audience, there's a Firefly fan saying, "How could he get that wrong?"
That's right. I apologize to that person. I guess that's the one that got away. And let's say this too. It's possible that next year I'm going to be saying the one that got away was Cthulhu Wars. We'll see.
We'll see when I get my copy.
I know you're getting your copy. I might be like, wow. And I also might be like, wow. I'm glad I didn't. We'll see.
Strangest watching TV moment this month, seeing Jewel State on Warehouse 13.
Oh, okay. I missed that. All right. So I had the horrible discovery. So I moved to the D.C. area, now closing on 2 years ago.
Ah, wow.
And
that is incredible.
Somewhere in the move,
We're glad you did.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so absolutely. The move from California to this area, or the move from where we were living before to where we are living now on Capitol Hill, I lost my copy of Kampfgruppe Piper 2.
Ooh, wow.
And also, actually, Pegasus Bridge. So Pegasus Bridge will be easier to replace, but
yeah.
Maybe it was a box you threw out that you thought was empty.
No. one thing though that has been on my list of things that got away that I am now going to get and may actually be waiting for me at home when I return is Where There Is Discord, which got reprinted and Noble Knight sent me a notice that it was available, so I jumped on that. All right, any others?
Can I retcon a little bit?
Yeah.
So I was just thinking about disappointments and surprises.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Disappointments, the Pathfinder card game.
Oh, right. I missed that.
I know you weren't here, and I almost feel like another game I should wheel out just so Tom can experience it. it's still getting so much love on the Geek, and I really wanted this to be awesome. And it wasn't terrible. It just wasn't actually very good. It wasn't very interesting, and you could really get kind of stuck because your life is your hand, and if the card you really need is the bottom and you didn't have any way of churning your deck, we'd only played like two missions, I think, you couldn't get it. And, I'm a cleric, I start off, I need a weapon, I need a mace, but you don't actually get to start with your mace, and if you don't draw it, you're in deep, deep trouble. And so it's just not,
it's like being a dwarf without a helmet.
That's right.
What'd you guys think of it?
Well, disappointment would mean I'd have to have high expectations.
I had high expectations. I did not.
I was kind of like, I wasn't like sighing going into it. I was just kind of like, oh, okay, I'll play this because we'll see what this is like. And when it wasn't that good, I was like, okay, that wasn't that good.
And part of it, I think, is because it was treading on the space of Project Ovaltine.
Yes,
a little
possibly,
bit,
possibly.
And I thought, oh my god, this is the game that we wanted to design.
Yeah,
but
it's not the game I wanted to design. And it was also, I guess if every person needs to experience it, I guess that also means that everyone should have gruel at some point in their time in life. You know, like a thin gruel. It doesn't really.
Can't you just get Campbell's tomato soup and water it down fivefold?
And not play Pathfinder card game. There you go.
Right. Everyone has to have their teeth cleaned sometime.
Exactly.
And. Mutant Chronicle Siege of the Citadel, which I had played like one or two times 15 years ago and had a pretty good time with. I thought it would be perfect for this group, and it didn't really work. It was not terrible, but it wasn't great, and it didn't surpass its mediocrity, and so I was disappointed.
It was a lot of fun the first night we played it.
Yeah.
It was just after the dungeon plugging, after we had realized that every dungeon crawlish game descends into dungeon plugging.
So briefly, Mutant Chronicles, I think, was Richard Borg. Is that
it
right?
I think it was his first game, actually.
And it has this
80s?
Very interesting property where it's two-sided team game. And so ideally you play it with five people. One person controls the baddies in a scenario. The other four control a team of two Space Marine type things, but it's not, you know, 40K environment, and then you play a scenario, you get points, you get experience, you're get more hit points or more better weapons for your Marines, and the guy who plays the baddie rotates, and so everyone gets to play the Overlord, the Dungeon Master, and everyone gets, and it's competitive. The problem is as you say, is that one of the key tactics for the Dungeon Master is simply jamming the dungeon full of bodies so that people can't get to their objective, and they lose victory points, depending on the scenario.
We jammed ourselves, though. I mean, I was guilty of that.
I agree with that. And I will also say it had that great 80s art that, like, decorated one corner of every game store in 1985. You know, it was that really
that was
bright
fine.
Color. Yeah. I loved it. It was, like, that bright color, like... what if Terminator, like Terminator on steroids of artwork, and it was, I loved it.
Not as bright as the box for Cuba Libre.
A few things are as bright as the box for Cuba Libre.
Any other retconning?
But yes, big surprise. Red Winter?
Yes.
I play
WBC. Yeah.
It's an operational World War II game set in, you know, the Soviet battle against Finland. Company-sized units, I think, which is an unusual size, but it was really good. It was very streamlined. Reading the rules, it was a labor of love. Really, really impressed, and I want to play more of that, actually.
Yeah, it was that nice balance of somebody who really sank into the history with then abstracting it well enough that it was still an interesting game.
Yeah.
And just the most interesting designer notes, and what a great game. Okay, so now on to the math portion of the exam. Most fun for the dollar. Now, we had offline, we had an interesting email exchange in which we came up with formulae for this. But just simple by the gut. You buy something, you feel like it's going to get you.
I'm confident that we're all going to agree on King of Tokyo.
Oh, I know!
Absolutely.
Right. Ding, ding,
right,
ding.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we play that as our filler game or at the end of the night.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's great.
What a great little game.
I mean, I would add Coup to that list.
Okay, yeah.
That was where I ended up. After I had crunched the numbers, I multiplied it by the square root of pi. I took the hours that I had played Coup, multiplied it by the square root of pi, and then divided it by the play quotient. And what I came up with was I came up with Coup.
Okay, so I have to confess, I was trying to see how far we could go with that conversation.
It was already dead.
Okay, I was trying to bait you into. Okay, so
if you want baiting, here's.
Aha!
No. The problem is if you divide by cost.
Yes.
The problem is then if someone got a game for a dime and it was okay and you played it for a few hours, but you divide by a dime, then it's gonna win the best game, you know, most fun for the dollar. So you really can't do it.
And I think MSRP. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the trick, is you got to say MSRP, and then it's fine.
Right. Because there are a lot of games, I think. Now, I'm skeptical we could come up with actually a very good formula for this, but a lot of the stuff that gets buzz and then doesn't get played after the buzz dies out, I mean, clearly, is not performing on this measure of fun for per dollar. You know, it's not like. You guys haven't played it, I don't think, you know, but Magic Realm, you know, like, okay. No, so once you get over the learning curve, and it's just a box full of fun. I mean, you play it for years and years and never get tired of it. ASL is like that, too. Okay, best electronic conversion of a board game in 2013. Mine is?
Yes.
Drum roll. Yes. Because I've been waiting to buy a physical copy for years after I regretfully sold mine, and I was an idiot for doing it.
Outpost?
No. Warhammer Quest.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah. I'll have to agree.
I agree.
I played the snot out of that thing when I first got it, and I haven't played it in a while because it's actually dangerous. Because I can get lost in it, and I'm like, I really shouldn't open that app.
Yeah. I think just go to this next village.
Right.
Just to see what's there.
Yeah.
I would also say for me, and I said this before, but I do think Elder Sign is an excellent app, and I think that its expansions have really made it an even better game, and they've done things that the board game could not do. Have you played any of the expansions?
Yes.
Okay, which ones have you? Did you play the Alaska one?
Yeah.
Did you play the Call of Cthulhu one?
Yep.
I thought that those were very interesting.
Yeah, they were. They took different segments,
It just absolutely took the game and took it in a new direction that really the board game can't. I mean, it... And I've said it before, I'll say it again. It is a better game than the board game.
Yes.
I
don't like the board game. I kind of like the iOS version.
I really like the iOS version. But I don't know if it qualifies as 2013. I think the expansions were 2013, so I guess I can do that.
Though I've reached the point where I could get to the end of the Ithaqua campaign.
Yes.
And I just couldn't save What's-Her-Face.
Yeah.
And I just said, I'm not going to play this until I do that. I just, okay.
Right.
Just to unlock a character now.
Right.
Okay, so others, best electronic conversion?
It's not 2013, but maybe they had a revamp of it, Niroshima Hex. Did they release that or something?
They released revision? An expansion.
Some armies.
Okay. At any rate, I hadn't played it. I played the physical board game, but it's so well done.
It's so well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that game.
Yeah.
Worst electronic conversion of a board game. I feel like I forgot something here in this category. There was something that came and went really fast, but.
For me, I mean, it's a family game that I've enjoyed, but it was a terrible iOS implementation. That was Survive, Escape from Atlantis.
Really?
Terrible.
Really?
Oh, yeah, really bad graphics, almost unplayable. And, you know, it was probably worse than Cyclades, which was the worst implementation ever.
Wait, they have Cyclades?
Yeah,
they kind of have one. There's no single player.
No multiplayer. Yeah, no single player, right.
Silly.
Yeah.
And that's too bad, because, I mean, Survive, I think, should be a family staple. If you have four people in your household, you probably should have Survive.
Yeah, and we've played it a bunch of times as a board game, but the implementation was totally clunky. And and I think they've redone it, and they've put out a patch. We used to call them patches. I don't know what they call them anymore, but I think they've kind of fixed it. But it was so bad when it came out, I'm still going to keep it on my list.
The only one I played was Eclipse, that was just we may have been the first people to actually finish a full game of asynchronous Eclipse, because it hadn't been out for very long, and it was so wonky you really had to just bludgeon your way through it.
How could anybody finish? Well, anyway, it took some dedication.
I think we definitely were the first people to finish it without having to go to therapy afterwards.
So I put down Brief History of the World.
Wait, they have an app for that?
Yes. And I'm putting it down because it's the worst asynchronous multiplayer experience I've had.
Huh.
Because you start playing it, and then if anybody decides to just ignore the game stops at that point. And there's no way of really recovering from it. There's no timeout. There's no person who started the game can override. It's just, it stops. So you've sunk time into something that's just then dead. I can't believe that somebody did that.
My problem was that it was A Brief History of the World.
Wait, I that's another game that I might try and drag back up, even though we didn't play it last year.
Feel free to do it on a week.
Oh no! All right, that's
not. It is neither Brief nor History of the World. I do not want to play it again.
All right, we play with too many people.
Okay, and also, actually, by the way, I should mention as an aside, I just found out yesterday. I don't know if you guys ever played the John Tiller computer games. Anyway, so there was a guy who designed a lot of computer war games about 10 to 20 years ago. So there were like battle games like Waterloo and Gettysburg and so forth for those time periods, and there was also a World War II series. Anyway, those are on the iPad, and I don't know how this got released without anybody noticing.
Huh.
But anyway, so if you look up John Tiller.
Okay.
And these are like solid war games that.
Okay,
you know,
I'll check that out.
Okay, so last of all, what do you want the most gaming wise in 2014?
Sounds like we're taking a test with my pencil ruling.
I want, I want to check something off of my gaming bucket list this year. And I think that probably with the big, I'm going to try to play a campaign scenario of an ASL historical module.
Oh. Oh, I'd be up for that.
Okay. All right. Well, we should.
I would love that.
Yeah. Because I would love to do that. That is something I would really like to do.
Yeah. Because all my experiences with that have been good.
Okay.
Including when I was playing with a really annoying person. It was still actually...
That'll fit?
Yes.
Win-win.
This guy would need training wheels first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, now that you said that, I'm going to play ASL with Kevin now.
I actually had a more generic thing, which is just play more two-player war games, because now that we're a group
too.
Of four, usually I don't get to play two-player games with you guys. So I have another person I play games with mostly weekly, but... There's a very, very short list of games that are allowed, essentially.
Yeah.
So I am omnivorous. I have a ton of games, and I have a ton of war games I would love to try and play, and I just don't get a chance to play them.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I would love to do that, but I'll be honest, I would hate to sacrifice this.
Oh, yeah.
This
I agree.
One of the best best couple years in my gaming has been the past couple years.
So I have more two-player war games, but I also have, and I keep harping on this, but I'm just so excited. And I asked my wife how to pronounce it, and I'm going to still mangle it. Le Vol de l'Aigle.
Flight of the Eagles?
Yes.
The
anyway.
Polish?
No. It's a umpired war game.
I know what it is.
Yeah. Napoleonic game. No, it's not miniatures.
It's actually get cardboard pieces?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it just sounds like terrific fun, and I've been reading about umpire games for years. I mean, that's kind of where wargaming started, but I never played one.
Yeah, so actually that's funny because, so this actually shows the miniatures versus board wargaming schism, where actually umpires are sort of de rigueur in miniatures in a lot of situations, unless it's a competitive one versus one, you know, tournament sort of game, and there's actually multiple types of miniature games, but in board games it's almost unheard of, and I actually think that there is space for saying, you know what, you got three guys that are interested in war games, we're going to make a short, tight game that requires an umpire, but it's going to be so much fun and so interesting and an experience you can't get anywhere else that a person's going to be willing to umpire because they know they're going to get to be a player when you guys rotate positions, and it will actually be really interesting as the umpire to see what's going on and how these guys are flailing around, because with an umpire, you're allowed to have information hidden from both sides, and you can sort of meet out the information, incorrect information. Just so much opens as soon as you say you can have a moderator or an umpire.
Yeah, so I'd love to play that. And actually, that reminds me of something else about miniatures game. I still do not understand about why it hasn't leaked into the board game hobby. So you have people who have played collectible card games or living card games who understand that there's fun in designing your deck, your force, or whatever. Okay, that's true of miniatures games, too.
Yeah.
Right. Why aren't there more toolkit-like games in the board gaming hobby, where you get, you know, a certain number of points, you can then put together a force and then play it? It is so conventional for other types of games
Well, so I think this actually goes back to this, one of the weird schisms in miniature wargaming versus board wargaming. Board wargaming is mostly about historical recreations. Like, yeah, this was a historical battle. We will do the best to produce the units and the terrain and the rules to make this one battle, and it will be a box, and you will buy this one battle. Yeah. Or maybe, if you're really lucky, they've put
the
four...
The order of battle is not subject to...
Right. It's historical. And you know, if something weird happened, somebody fell off their horse and broke their neck, and they couldn't command for 6 hours, you bake that into the rules. Roll on the table to see when you fall off your horse and you can't give orders, or get drunk or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the commander can't give orders. And it's like, you know, that's just... It's a Disney ride. It's like, oh, I'm on rails, I'm going through the battlefield, and I, you know, it's not quite like that because you're going to move forces around. But if it doesn't reproduce the battle closely enough, people get upset.
Mm-hmm.
And in a box, maybe you're lucky you get four versions, four games from the same sort of era. But in miniatures, you get a system.
Yeah.
And there will be, you know, and there may be a guy who's just crazy, and he collects all the figures to do Gettysburg or, you know, some Napoleonic battle, and he puts out the terrain and he hosts it and a bunch of people come and it's a team game and it's a lot of fun. But more often it seems to be, it's a sandbox. You know, you either build your forces and you have points, or if you don't have points, it's like the umpire says, you get this, this is a plausible scenario, go.
And it's all part of the appeal of deck building games, and now more recently incorporating deck building mechanics into war games.
And I'm looking at Mage Knight here across the room, and you know, like you could think of a game like that where you have a deck building that happens before the game starts. I can buy certain cards and then, you know, try that out, and if that doesn't work out too well, the next time I play, I try a different combination.
And I think there's some of that that's starting to seep into gaming. I think Mage Wars is supposed to do that.
Yeah.
I know that Star Trek.
Attack Wing?
Fleet Captains, not Attack Wing, it's a board game. It definitely did that. It was like you set this deck that was your command ability for your starships, and not say personalities in it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You had these different decks you were drawing from, you built this little deck, and then that was what you played with for that game. And so you definitely were. I think it's called Fleet Captains.
Okay.
I just did a Romulan border expansion.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
I played that.
And it's a weird game. I mean, it's a weird, like... You're kind of exploring and you're kind of fighting.
Yeah.
But it's definitely starting to pull that customize your deck into it. The problem is that we're not seeing it with the historical stuff, I think.
So part of the reason why they do it in miniatures may simply be that it is a huge amount of effort to buy the figures, paint the figures, base them, and all this, and make them look nice. And you can't afford to have a boutique... very specific set of lead or white metal figures or for every single historical battle. And so what you can do is you plausibly have a grab bag of units, and you can reconfigure them in different ways to make an interesting battle, but you just don't have everything available to make that particular battle and that particular battle, that particular battle. So it may be a limitation of their components that forces them to play in the sandbox manner.
Okay, but way back when Avon Hill published Napoleon's Battles.
Yeah, which was a miniatures game with
just
cardboard tokens.
With cardboard tokens and so forth. And
people still play
clearly
that.
Clearly, it's cheaper
figures.
To have cardboard tokens.
Yes.
Yeah, so, constructing a force in out of the box in a game like that would not be hard and wouldn't be expensive. And I don't know, because there's so much that people find engaging about the force design.
Yeah, so...
Or the deck design. I don't know why there isn't more of that.
So one testing ground for this may be Combat Commander, in its sense that the Mediterranean, they came out with a really robust scenario design. Mm-hmm. And so there's actually three legs to this triad. There's a historical scenario, even if it's only a plausible squad leader and stuff, it's an abstraction. Like, oh, here's a historical battle, I'll close my eyes, I'll use the force, and I'll create units that sort of look like what was there. Bigger battles, it's usually very devoted to exactly the units that were there. And then you have the point system, in DBM or something like this, where you have certain points and you say, well, I have a list I can build from and I'm going to spend points to get this, this, and this and optimize it and make a really cool force. But then there's also the scenario generators, like the old squad leader 4th edition that had roll your own forces.
Mm-hmm.
Combat Commander has this too. And it looks like it could be a ton of fun generating random, plausible, interesting scenarios. But it doesn't give you the, here's points, build your own combat commander force.
I hope it's part of Upfront, because that was actually kind of fun.
There was a
DOII part of Upfront. I assume it's part of the reprint. But
there was a...
Will happen, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, no doubt.
So there was a famous article in the General called... It was a design, you know, design your own scenario with points.
Yeah.
Using like 500 points, and it was a campaign, and it was a variant that wasn't really in the rule book. It's apparently was very, very popular, and I never got a chance to play it. But looking ahead, I actually have two things. One, shortly, Dune with Kevin. Because
that would be fun.
I haven't played Dune in a long time. I really like the game, but I've never been around someone that really knew the game very well.
So you weren't in that WBC game?
No, I wasn't. Oh, I wasn't. And I really, really want to play Dune with someone who's actually able to answer all the questions. And,
yeah, that'd be better for a week where we have five or six. I mean,
yeah,
four,
no, no, six,
four
yeah, yeah, and I'm happy to play the Bene Gesserit, and I'll fall on that sword. But then the one board game I'm actually looking forward to probably the most is from Plaid Hat Games called Dead of Winter. Have you guys heard of this?
Oh, yeah, I did hear about
this. I'm getting
more
and more excited about this. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be
superb. You should explain what it is.
Dead of Winter is a kind of a weird zombie-themed game that's got co-opetition.
I don't know what that is.
So it's supposedly part of a series. So you're a group of survivors. The apocalypse has happened. You have this tiny little community. You're trying to survive. I think they have scenarios, different scenarios. And you have a small band of like two or three people you start with. And... there's trials and tribulations that you have to collectively meet, like Shadows Over Camelot. One of you may or may not be the traitor. You may have no traitor in the group. You can choose to exile people, and everyone has their own card that gives you a special victory condition. So while you have to all survive as a group, then you look at your individually victory conditions. I could be slightly wrong on this, but if you get exiled because people think you're the traitor, you actually draw another exiled victory condition, so your victory condition is now different. And there's this thing, a crossroads deck, that basically the person that's just taken their turn will draw a card and see if a trigger condition is met. You know, certain characters are in play, people are at certain locations, and if so, there's sort of like this narrative story thing that happens where you read it out loud and there's a choice to be made. Either the person with the card gets to make the choice one way or another, or maybe the whole group has to vote on what happens, but there seemed like there's a really strong narrative thing that's injected, and it's not random. It's not just like, you know, choose something random from Tales of the Arabian Nights, which just can be fun, I guess, but it's just random nonsense, throw things up in the air and see what happens. This seems like it gives you more sort of cluster of interesting moments of semi-narrative cohesiveness in a survival horror game. Could be awesome.
It could be. I'm scared of the narrative, but it could be awesome.
Made me think of a disappointment from 2013, which was the, what's it called? House on the Hill?
The Trail
on House on the Hill.
Oh, I didn't get to play
it.
It
looked like it was going to be so cool, and it was just lame.
Yeah. And I, you know, my other thing for 2014 is not to be away for 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
Especially not with being in Calgary in a blizzard at the end.
Although you found that game store.
Yes, that game store. Listeners, if you ever are in Calgary, go to the game store, the Century Box in that town. That is just fantastic.
I will do that if I'm ever there again. I've been nice.
Now, before I start into this episode's audio essay, which is about Kickstarter, I just want to say something that I think is important up front so that there isn't any misperception here. I'm a person who has invested in Kickstarter projects galore. Everything from Guns of Gettysburg to Promised Land, from the reprint of the Columbia Games Napoleon classic title to God Help Me, I invested in Cthulhu Wars up to the eyeballs, so clearly I see some good in Kickstarter, but let me say something that worries me, and I'll just go straight to Upfront as the illustration of what I'm talking about. So it seems like there's been a lot of delays with Upfront that can be attributable to a number of different issues. One of them certainly is the complexity of what this project turned into. So back in the day, when Avalon Hill originally published Upfront, it was a great game that had three nationalities in it, the Americans, the Soviets, and the Germans, And then they published a couple of expansions. The Banzai expansion added the British and the Japanese. The Desert War expansion added the Italians and the French. And unfortunately, then Avalon Hill crumbled, and Upfront went into limbo. Multi-Man Publishing was talking about redoing it for a long, long time, but that never quite materialized. So I was overjoyed to see that somebody had restarted a real Upfront reprint project on Kickstarter. And as Kickstarters go, it followed a fairly traditional script with, okay, there's a time limit to how long it's going to take in order to get funding, but it seemed pretty obvious who was going to get funding. There's a certain time limit that's implicit in how long it should take to get the project done, but I'm not so much worried about living up to the strict letter of when people estimate it's going to be finished, because all projects don't turn out exactly the way that you expect them to. And then there were the extras, and the extras were a lot of new nationalities, Gurkhas, Norwegians, you name it, and these were stretch goals that if the project got funded up to a particular level, then the new Upfront would include these. And those were nice to haves. I mean, really, as somebody who owns a copy of Upfront, in fact, I have two copies of the base game and a copy of each of the expansions to play with, I'm certainly set Upfront-wise. If the reprint did a great job of providing a better production value or did something else that made it noteworthy, great. But really, I invested in it because primarily I wanted to make sure that Upfront was available to another generation of wargamers who would have to get it through eBay or a flea market at a convention or something like that. And although there are copies available, they're not cheap, and certainly the expansions are much more expensive than I think most people can afford. So that was really what I hoped to see. And then, there were the delays, and I'm not going to go into anything about the legal issues or things like that, because it's not the point of this video essay, and frankly, I don't have the expertise to comment on any of that. But, most recently, since some of the updates, we were getting a lot of pictures of the new factions, i.e. nationalities, and scant information about the status of when the thing would actually be published. Just a lot of, well, it's going to be done soon, we're working on it, we have a volunteer who's working on it and doing a lot of the copy editing of the rules, etc., etc. Fine, but what I fear is the following. So let's say a game like Upfront comes out and they have all these new factions. How do we know that these aren't going to imbalance the game? Games are finely tuned mechanisms, or at least they should be. After a lot of play testing, people have to figure out what it was about the original design that was imbalanced, favoring one faction or another, or made the game not terribly fun, or made it play too long. And that's the kind of thing that I think really was already baked into Upfront. You didn't need to change anything. But when you started adding more factions to it, it raised the risk of, let's say, the Gurkhas were overpowered compared to everybody. Anybody that you could pick might be a candidate for being too weak or too strong. And certainly there have been discussions over the years about whether some of the base factions from the originally published Avalon Hill game or the expansions had a slight edge over the others. So there's that problem. The other problem is certainly the more you take on as a project, the longer it's going to take to get done. And I personally, if they break up the project into multiple phases and say we'll ship the core game, that's great. But we'll get the other stuff out later. I think that's perfectly reasonable, rather than trying to do it all in one gigantic lump. I think also that it's perfectly reasonable to expect that whatever tweaks are happening, and there have been murmurings about tweaks to the rules or tweaks to some cards or whatever, that gets play tested to death, so it doesn't none of those changes throw a great game out of whack. And the more that attention gets paid on the production or other issues that the extras bring up, the less time there is to playtest that stuff. So that, to me, is not necessarily a problem with one particular Kickstarter project, but it is, I think, an example of perhaps the perverse incentives in Kickstarter that might throw a lot of games out of whack and guide the people who are in charge of the project down the wrong path, to mix a metaphor or two. So, you know, to go to Cthulhu Wars, for example, okay, so there are lots and lots of factions and lots of boards and lots of this and that and the other thing. And a lot of that, presumably, Sandy Peterson and other people working on this threw in because that would help get funding. But again, the more things you have, the greater the risk that something isn't going to quite work. And if it's an just an extra that you can ignore, great, you know, or house rule it or whatever. But if it throws the game fundamentally out of whack because it's considered to be part of the core game, or it meant that people weren't paying attention to playtesting the core system or writing a clear rule book or whatever, then that's not a good thing. You know, if other game designers think that they have to put in extras, I'm glad that, for example, that A Study in Emerald, which we just got and played a couple of times, that it didn't have additional cards or additional things that were relevant to the game as Kickstarter incentives. Same goes for Promised Land. I appreciated the nice extra bits to replace some of the components that other people would get. That, but that's, you know, I think a nice to have, like a lot of the things that we're talking about, and that's fine. But I'm glad it wasn't something that potentially could screw up the game. But you know, you have again these perverse incentives. You have people who are chomping at the bit to get the game that they invested in, and that might put undue pressure on designers and publishers to get things to market before they're strictly ready. Or it might be that the oddball game that doesn't have mass appeal might turn out to be a terrific game that would have mass appeal had it been published, but it doesn't get the funding because it's, you know, not something that people have familiarity with. It's a new idea for a whole new kind of game, or it's a topic that people aren't familiar with, like, you know, like World War One was before Paths of Glory. And maybe that's fine. Maybe it just means that those are not projects for Kickstarter, but it does mean that Kickstarter isn't necessarily the foolproof avenue for innovation that some may assume that it is. And last, I'll just say that just kind of the economic logic of trying to get something funded in the first place, there's no barrier to people posting reviews of games that haven't even been funded yet on BoardGameGeek or posting them on their blogs or whatever. And if you know me, you know I have a kind of a pet peeve about reviews that don't really give a game a fair shake because they haven't been played enough times. But I would say definitely I have a pet peeve about reviewing something that may not be the game that ultimately gets published. In which case, I think it's just a form of marketing under the guise of buyer's advice, and I wish that these previews were labeled a little bit more clearly as such. And also, too, I found a couple of times some fairly obnoxious shilling that was going on BoardGameGeek around Kickstarter projects about, oh, this is really cool, this is probably one particular project that my friend is doing, cough, cough. Anyway, so as I said, not a rant against Kickstarter. I don't think it's going to be a bad force necessarily in every possible way, but I think for people who don't necessarily have a lot of project management skill or who get wrapped up in knots because they're not familiar with the printing process, this is the first time they've ever had to work with printers or people doing plastic pieces or whatever, and geez, if Martin Wallace can even get tied up in knots over plastic pieces, as he apparently kind of ran into some production issues with Munga Invaders. I'm sure that people who have not published games before are going to have their own sets of challenges. I also think it's not necessarily good for people who are first-time game designers, because again, there's this siren lure of trying to get something out faster than perhaps the game really needs to be released. It just may need more time to percolate, or if you have a great idea that forces you to, you know, go back to square one on some aspects of the game, fine. Better that than publishing something before it's ready in a much inferior form. or people who aren't used to game design and don't really understand the risks that they're taking by adding complexity to the game through through various incentives that they've put together as stretch goals. So, you know, yes, I think that means that it does somewhat favor experienced designers and already extant game companies. But I think that's just the nature of the beast, unfortunately. And I'll still be interested personally in the oddball game that comes up from somebody that I never heard of before. But I guess I have to understand that I'm taking a significant risk then that the game won't show up. And I think when game reprints get done and they put on Kickstarter, please just reprint them. please don't overdo it and turn it into something far more complicated to bring to market than it needs to be. Because now I'm even wondering, in the case of Upfront, whether there will be a version that shows up in game stores or is available for purchase from an online retailer. And I think that's a general issue about Kickstarter. Does it really kind of get people to kind of exhaust themselves getting the Kickstarter version done without really a clear plan for what comes next? Well, thanks for listening to episode 49 of I've Been Dice. This is Tom Grant. Next episode, number 50, we officially enter podcast midlife crisis, I guess, with episode 50. So looking forward to that. I hope you are too. We're going to be doing more war game interviews soon, as well as panel discussions like the one that you heard tonight. And so until our next disembodied digital meeting, I hope your next gaming experience is terrific. Take care.
Don't copy.
No, I'm just trying to write down the topics. I probably won't contribute anything.
I'll interject. The topics as we go, right?
Yes, of course. Okay.
I'm not going to contribute. I don't have anything prepared. I don't know anything.
I'm sure you are. Yeah.